Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II podcast. And as I promised you yesterday for the redeployment episode of Adam Makos' first time on the show, I said, don't worry, we'll all be back together soon. We'll all be here for you. I mean, what a great episode that was to have Adam Makos on our... Jeff, I know you're the same way. Have you ever sat back on a quiet day or maybe talking to a friend and realized the effing people we've had on this show? Dan Carlson,
it's
Adam
funny
Makos.
You say that. I got a call this morning from some old friends that volunteered at the park when I was a park ranger. Haven't heard from them in about 5 years. They've got some artwork, historical artwork they want to give me. That's the exact conversation. Because I had to get them all caught up. I haven't seen them since I left. You know, when I basically took an early retirement from Parks and Wildlife, and it was like, yeah, we knew you were at, you know, the Nimitz, and then now we just heard you're a teacher, and like all the stuff we see online, like what is it you do? And I kind of gave them a elevator speech of how it has dominoed and how, you know, what's the scuttlebutt has like snowballed so much and the opportunities it's given us. It's been what a ride, man.
When you do that, when you take your life and you start putting it on Instagram and Facebook, especially what we do and all the different things we do, especially me having a YouTube channel, it makes me realize all the different crap I'm into. Because like you see a lot of people's Instagram, it's one thing, right? It's all fishing, or it's all hunting, or all running, or all gym, or all history, whereas all of our Instagrams and social medias, family vacation, World War II stuff, car stuff. And Carrie's like, your YouTube channel's all over the place. I said, well, that's why I have playlists. I'm a dynamic person. I have many interests. So, but yeah, it's amazing, you know, all the different things that we're all into, which is why when we have people on this show, we don't do it so much now, but back in the day when I had living historians on or authors, I always like to ask people, especially the living historians, because I think it's cool. And the three of us are a perfect example. I mean, I'm an IT guy, you're a teacher, and you work at museums, and Dennis works at a horse ranch, and he has his history and, you know, being a trauma tech. But I always think it's interesting when we, especially living historians, bring them on here to find out what they do for a living. And just to show people, we all come from different walks of life. We just share this one passion. That's the history of World War II.
Yeah, and it definitely brings a lot of different people together. Like you said, I know just from my volunteer group that I ran at the museum, you had people from all walks of life and, you know, all these other different interests. But when we came together for that first formation, and Don, you were there for some of them, we're all connected as a family now, and it doesn't matter what we do on the outside. Like, we have this one link that kind of binds us all, and that is our passion and love for World War II. So yeah, for sure.
When your guys showed up, it was almost like boot camp, because what you guys did at the Nimitz was a lot different than what a lot of people do, because you guys had the ability to provide uniforms. And so when I say your guys like boot camp, they all just showed up in a white t-shirt and gym trunks and then stood in line and waited for the quartermaster to issue their uniforms. Whereas most conventional living historians, a majority of the guys show up on site in their uniform. And it's always been weird to me. Like, a lot of these guys I've known for 10, 15 years, but I've only seen them at living history events. And every once in a while, one of them will have to leave early on a Sunday and they'll go change out of their clothes and they'll walk up. You're like, I never pictured you for a polo guy tucked into a pair of khaki shorts, but okay, that works. It's always weird to see guys that you've known for 10 years wearing nothing but uniforms just to see, you're a sagging starter shorts with a bull's hat guy. Okay. You know, it's always interesting to see how people dress when they're, because you get a glimpse at who they are outside of the living history world. And I always think it's always a fun little game to see who's that walking up wearing. Oh, okay. That works for you. it's funny to see, but yeah. Speaking of opportunities that this podcast has created or just made us aware of, or people we've had access to, you and obviously Scott Gibson was on 2 weeks ago promoting this event you guys are going to go to. And I'll let the cat out of the bag. That living history event that went on in Texas there, the Marine Corps one, the Peleliu, I was supposed to go to that. I've been in on the ground floor of the planning stages on the Facebook pages. Six of the guys who planned that, they all were at the Peleliu event in Alabama and the Tarawa event. I could not financially afford to make that trip to Texas this year. Maybe next year I can make it. But yeah, I was supposed to go to that event. I've been putting, you know, making sure my shit was in gear. It's just, I couldn't make it. I'm seeing those photos now. I'm like, God, I wish I could have made that trip, but not with a V8 Tundra. And you've driven to Florida. I don't just live like in Florida. I live damn near at the end of the country. So it's not like I'm in Orlando. Just got to make a quick 6-hour drive out of the, no, it's, you made that drive down here. How far was that from you to where you filmed down here for Walking Point?
Man, that's a great question. I mean, I can tell you this much. When a couple years ago now, when we lost one of the guys I served with, we drove straight through to Jacksonville.
Okay.
And that was 19 hours.
Jacksonville's about 7 hours from me, maybe six.
Yeah. So I can't exactly, when we came out to film Walking Point outside of Fort Myers there, I'm trying to remember where we stayed. We did not drive straight through with my wife and kids.
No, there's no way.
We stayed somewhere, and I couldn't tell you. I want to say we stayed somewhere in Alabama, maybe.
Yeah, probably outside of Fort Morgan area. Actually, no, Jacksonville is about 6 hours, because when I went to that Fort Morgan event, driving from Cape Coral to there, it's about a 9-hour drive, not counting stopping for gas and food. And so that's just from here to the end of the Panhandle. So to make that extra drive from the Panhandle to Texas, I mean, that's, yeah, it's got to be easily a 17, 18-hour drive, if not longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, I was supposed to go to that event. I wish I could have. And it didn't even occur to me that that was, you know, even remotely related to what you guys were going out there to do. So explain to the audience what you guys went to and who you got to meet and the photo ops and whether or not you were able to accomplish your mission of booking a guest.
Well, so like you said, you know, we had Scott Gibson on a few weeks ago, and he had kind of mentioned in a phone conversation with me that he was coming to Texas. And I said, oh, where are you coming? He goes, I think we're going to be near Fredericksburg at the museum. And I was like, oh, dude, let me know. Like, keep me up to date. And even up to the day that Dennis and I were at the event, I was still, like, unsure what the event was, because talking to Scott, it was like, oh, there's some reenactors, and he said they're recreating Peleliu, and, of course, somehow, like, somebody asked him to come down there, and he said, yeah, sure. He's like, I'm not going to put on a uniform and play Army. I'm not going to be, you know, Haldane, but I'll go. And I don't exactly know the correlation between that, the living history, like the tactical or the immersive,
it was a tactical event, but
program. And the awareness, and I guess maybe even a little fundraising to get Scott and one of the World War II vets that was there with us last weekend as well. He was a Navy vet, and I think he served or was stationed in around Guam. They're traveling back to Peleliu in September for the 80th. So there's a lot of moving parts there that I didn't quite put all the pieces together.
I didn't know of any relation of outside of the tactical, just from the Facebook group I've been a part of. I just knew it was going to be a tactical event. I wasn't aware that they had associated themselves with a fundraising group, which is awesome. I do know that from seeing the photos, some of the Japanese reenactors are actual Japanese reenactors, those same ones that we flew in from Japan for the Tarawa and Peleliu event. And so, which one of the gentlemen gave me a pack of modern day Japanese branded Lucky Strike cigarettes with the Japanese writing on them, which I have in my display case. But seeing those photos, man, it's just like, wow, that area, the property in which they held that on, compared to like some of the original photos, it's pretty damn close.
Yeah. And it's the same location they did a big Iwo Jima anniversary for years ago. And if you're familiar with World War II, Beyond the Call, the founder of that, her name's Tracy McClellan, she was there as well. And I remember Scott talking about Tracy being there, and I think Tracy was the one that kind of organized them going through the museum. And all that. And I didn't even have a chance to talk to Tracy. She ended up just, she sent me a follow, you know, request on Instagram. And I'd like to kind of get her on the show as well, because what she does as a World War II documentary, like, filmmaker is, she's done some amazing stuff too. So, but back to the event. So Scott and I were on the phone one night and we're talking about it and just kind of going over the details. We were like a few weeks out. And I just happened to, like, jokingly say, man, I know, you know, Captain Dale Dye lives somewhere in that area, because I was going to see about reaching out to him to surprise all of Company K, you know, the reenactment group down there. And I just never really followed through with it. And he goes, yeah, he said, I think he does live in that area. He said, you know what? I haven't talked to Dale in a couple years. Maybe I'll give him a shout. And then it seemed like within days, then I see this advertisement for National Museum Pacific War that Scott and Dale Dye are going to be like a meet and greet and everything. And I was like, what? So it was kind of a strange event, because, like I said, I didn't really know too much about it. And so, in all honesty, it put Dennis and I in an awkward position several times, because we had no idea there were so many other people that were, like, responsible for keeping, like, putting this event together. So there were several.
Hold on, pause for a second. Your internet's breaking up. Let's wait for the buffer to sort out.
Okay.
Try now?
I don't know.
Go ahead. It put you and Dennis in a hard spot because...
Oh, yeah. It put Dennis in a hard spot because there was a lot of other people that were associated with the event, and we didn't exactly know how it was going to look. So we just knew, Scott said, hey, we're going to go through the museum from this time to this time. You know, be really disappointed if you couldn't meet us. So I'm like, okay. That was our plan. Let's meet them so we can go to the museum. And we did. It was nice. We had about a two-hour tour. I got to see the museum director, which I haven't seen him in a few years. You know, worked for him. And some of the volunteers, of course, we saw later on that were in Company K with me. But we got separated from Scott because he's on the panel with Dale as a meet and greet, and these other two veterans. The two World War II veterans have their handlers.
Mm-hmm.
So... you know, like, there was a time where, well, they were going to lunch. Lunch was provided for them. And then the rest of us were just like, well, I guess we're on our own. And, I mean, so at first it was like we were kind of awkward. So we walk out of the last exhibit of the museum, and there is the one and only Eli Double Tap from Black Rifle and Unsubscribed Podcast just standing there. I'm like... hey, and he's like, hey, and I was like, remember me? I was the flamethrower guy, and he's like, what?
Should have him on the show. So,
yeah, it was like nuts. So we're talking about when we did Brothers in Arms together, and he's like, oh man, I got to introduce you to some of the other guys. So we do that, and then they invite us to go to lunch with them.
Nice.
So Dennis and I, and Dennis's girlfriend, we're just at this table with all of these other people, and like Jack Mandeville, if you've ever seen Range 15. Jack Mandeville was there. Like, I couldn't believe what was going on. Like, it just seemed like all of a sudden we went from, oh, okay, bummer, we're not going to actually get to really have a good conversation with Scott, like, at all, to, okay, I guess we're going to hang out with Unsubscribed Podcast today. And
was Brandon
that led
there too?
To go ahead.
Was Brandon there too, the whole crew?
No, I invited Brandon, but he didn't make it.
No, I was talking about Brandon Herrera from Unsubscribed Podcast.
Oh, yes, he was here. Oh, yeah, yeah. I thought you were talking about somebody else, another Brandon. Yeah, like the whole crew from Unsubscribed was there.
That's awesome.
And like the whole crew. And so after lunch, we go to the meet and greet, and we look at, you know, we're listening to Dale and Scott and the other two World War II veterans, and they showed some clips of Scott as Captain Haldane, which was pretty cool. And some people asked some pretty decent questions. And then I offered the guys from Unsubscribe, you know, they're like, hey, we really wanted to go through the museum. And I was like, well, I'll take y'all through, you know,
I'm
if you got about an hour, hour and a half, let's do it. And Dennis will tell you, I gave them an hour and a half of content.
Yeah,
because sure. The cameraman was rolling the whole time, And we talked a lot about, you know, Eli's like, oh, dude, we've got to have you on the show. We got to have you on the show. Oh, man. And they're right there. I mean, they're 2 hours from where I live. So that's going to happen. I told him, I said, well, then obviously we want to have you on What's the Scuttlebutt. All the cross-pollination he kept, you know, talking about. And, man, let me tell you, when he told me, so Unsubscribe has 32,000 subscribers.
I was watching
monthly
today.
Subscribers. And some of their content, you know, and he kept like warning me. He's like, dude, there's some dark humor.
Like, yeah, hey, your mic's breaking
awesome.
Up. Your mic's
don't
break-
do that. What's the scuttlebutt?
Your mic's breaking up. Hold on, pause. Let the buffer break out. That's all right. While we're waiting on that, yeah, I just watched their recently released episode where it had the son, the victim of the gentleman who shot the sexual abuser at the Louisiana airport in 1984 for molesting his kid. His kid's now like 53, and so they had him on the show, and they're talking about, you know, that whole kidnapping, how his karate teacher kidnapped him and took him to California and all that came out of that, and that's why his dad shot him at the airport. And what had happened to him was so yeah. heinous that his dad literally killed his groomer on national TV in 1984 and got 300 hours of community service. That was it.
Wow.
Because the guy was such an evil person. Like, the judge, like, there's no reason to send you to jail. Just 300 hours of community wow. service. But, yeah, that was on this week's episode. And that's, like, I've watched a lot of their episodes. That's the one few they actually put a disclaimer at the beginning of the episode. Like, yeah, if you're triggered by this topic, you may want to find another episode to watch. But yeah, they do got yeah. some dark humor. But I'm fans of all of their channels. So it's awesome that not only did you guys get to eat lunch with them, that you got to give them a tour. I mean, who better give a tour? I mean, you gave the tour to me when you were there. Did you see Aaron while you're out there? Is he still working in the mechanic shop?
I guess. We didn't go down to the combat zone.
Okay.
We were just in the main gallery.
Sure.
I never even did go down to the battlefield. And,
yeah.
You know, that's old history.
Yep.
It's I hear all the changes. It's like, I don't even know if I want to go, you know. But yeah, I mean, they're going to share some stuff with me. I mean, we did take a good group photo together with me with all the guys and Dennis. I believe you were in that shot, right? You got in the group shot?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And
the man,
you know,
the
whatever they put together.
The yeah, seriously, let's if they yeah, we'll talk about that off the air, but that's super cool. I'm excited for you
yeah.
guys that you got to make that happen. How was you? You got to meet Dale, right?
We did. So that was kind of after the fact. Right at the end of the meet and greet is when I gave Unsubscribe their tour, and then we linked back up with them at a restaurant, which was super busy. And there was quite a few other people that were at the meet and greet. You know, some of the museum staff and everybody. Everybody's kind of crowded in the restaurant. And Dennis and I were just like, okay. We're going to be sitting here for a while. And so I said my goodbyes to Scott's, you know, I was like, hey man, I'm going to go, you know, I got some other stuff. I mean, they just had people climbing on them. And of course Dale Dye, like you couldn't get a word in edgewise with him. So when I went to say goodbye to Scott, you know, he got up, hugged me. He's like, dude, we'll link up later for sure. He said, hey, did you get a picture with Dale? And I said, no. And he goes, hey, let's get a picture together. So luckily, Dennis was there, took a good picture of the three of us, and handed him the business card. And I, you know, told him very briefly about the podcast. I said, but it's a World War II based podcast, sir. We would be remiss if we did not, you know, invite you to be a guest. And he goes, well, I got the invite. Now let's work out the details. You know, I said, okay,
we're good at details.
So
that, hold on, stop, hold on. Let's not pass over that damn near superb Dale Dye impression. I'm trying to think of one of the lines that he's
that was pretty good.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a line that he said in Band of Brothers that we could have you repeat. Maybe we'll work on that for the future.
Or how about Saving Private Ryan? We go traipsing off looking for some, what does he say? On some wild goose chase. On some wild goose chase. We go traipsing, frankly, sir, we go traipsing off in some wild goose right. chase looking for some. He's going to have another KIA or something like that.
That was a damn good Dale Dye impression.
Anyway, yeah, so
I sidled up beside him a couple times in the museum there.
Yeah.
While while, you know, he'd be off by himself, and I'd just kind of like do an old Fred Flintstone, the little toes, like digga 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 digga.
He has one of those distinct voices.
I sidle up next to him, and he was looking at Tarawa. And I sidled up next to him, and I says, "Yes, sir. I interviewed about 10 guys from this battle, and a couple of the men guys mentioned 6-foot Japanese guys coming out into the water after them. You ever hear about that?" And he was talking to me about that, and so I definitely got some time alone with Dale Dye there. It was pretty cool. I think he really enjoys just being treated just like another guy, and just having conversations, which is what we did.
But he has one of those distinctive voices, you know, when he's in the room. You know, you could be just, you could like not even know he was supposed to be there, looking at the display yourself and hear him talk. You're like, wait a minute. You know, if that was a Scott Gibson talking behind you and you didn't know he was there, you probably wouldn't distinguish, you know, maybe one of us who's heard the dialogue so many times, but, you know, even somebody who's seen Pacific didn't know Scott was there, heard talking, probably wouldn't, but you recognize Dale Dye when he's talking in the room. He's just got one of those voices.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But you know, I will say this about the program. There was maybe, if there was a disappointment, I will say this. I don't think the staff really fully grasped like the importance of those two actors. And I'd like to kind of pick the director's brain on it a little bit. He had some friends coming in, so he met us at the gallery at 10 o'clock and kind of gave us a little brief like intro tour of what used to be the temporary gallery. And Don, I don't know if you ever went in the temp gallery exhibit, but it changed every 3 months. But now they're rebuilding all of that, and they're doing like this big – it's not going to be a temp exhibit anymore. It's a part of the museum tour. But it's submarine based, and you know, about a real submarine, and a little bit of World War II Museum New Orleans-y type stuff, a little more interactive. But when Dale walked up, you know, he was kind of one of the last ones there, and nobody really was like, "There's Dale Dye." You know, it was just like, "Oh, is everybody here? Let's start the tour." You know, and I thought that was kind of funny that the, you know, some of the staff wouldn't be like, "Before I go home, let me like shake your hand. Let me shake your hand." I didn't really see any of that. And then later on in the tour, right before we go to Tarawa, Dennis, you might remember, right before we go in the Tarawa exhibit is the Sullivan brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's like a little room off to the side that just talks about the Sullivan brothers.
They have the hatch there, don't they?
What's that?
Don't they have a hatch there from that vessel?
Or they have a hatch from the Arizona.
Yeah, well, I knew they had a hatch, or maybe it was a – I might be thinking of another display. I remember Sullivan. I thought they had – okay, yeah, so they had a hatch there. I was getting confused. Oh, no, yeah. What it was, the famous photo of the Sullivan brothers is near a hatch door. That's why I made that transition, but go ahead, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, and the volunteer leading the tour, we kind of skipped over it. He goes, "Hey, and this behind me, this is about the Sullivan brothers. You know, is everybody familiar with that?" And he said, "Well, has anybody ever seen Saving Private Ryan?" And of course, we're all like, "Duh!" And of course, Dale Dye, he was standing right next to Time. He goes, "Seen it? Hell, I made it."
I was going to ask you
it caught me.
Let me maybe this will help. The demographic of the volunteers giving the tours, were they older than us, younger than us, same age as us?
Yeah, no, he was older. I mean, he's been there for a while, but still it kind of caught me off guard because it was like, that's a funny joke if you obviously know this is Captain Dale Dye standing 10 feet away from you.
Yeah, for sure.
But it was delivered in a way that was like, this is a serious question. Like, do you not know who these people are? So
yeah, it's like,
that kind of caught me off guard.
Was there not a memo like at the beginning of everybody's shift that morning? "Hey, we got some very important people coming today."
Maybe he didn't know.
Yeah, I don't know if he knew. I think it was just, "Hey, you're going to lead a tour from 10 to 12 for some people and some World War II vet." You know, I don't know, but there was one post I saw on social that like advertised the meet and greet. Had a picture of Dale Dye, picture of Scott Gibson, a whole bunch of stuff about the Pacific.
That's a shame.
But I even had to ask the director. I was like, "Hey, where is the meet and greet? Because that's not even on the advertisement." But
anyhow,
you know, I'm not downing the museum in any way. It was just surprising to me when you have a caliber, you know, or somebody of that caliber coming to your place. That should have been a huge shindig, the way I see it. Especially two World War II veterans coming through that traveled pretty far. I mean, Don lives outside of Dallas, so is what it is. It was a really fun event. Yes, I'm sure we're going to hear from Dale Dye and have him on. I can't wait to announce that news. I mean, he was interested. It's very simple to do what we do to have him on. So it's going to be a great episode. And it's definitely, we're not going to spend an hour asking him questions that we can Google the answers to. Sure. And I think he knows that. But other than that, it was great to see Scott. And we're going to see Scott again the first weekend of October. And Dennis is going to come hang out with us as well with the Wish for Our Heroes gala that I went to last year, if you remember that, when I got to meet Kyle Chandler and some of the San Antonio Spurs and some other actors. And it's a big event there in San Antonio. And Scott goes to several of the galas. They have them quarterly. He goes to Pearl Harbor in December for it. And then there's one in, I think they do one in Minneapolis. And then it was founded here in San Antonio by a former Army captain. He started this Wish for Heroes, and then it's also part of the Walk Among Heroes, where they travel to Normandy in June every year. That's who Scott goes to Normandy with, that group. So
now, does Scott have a place?
They raise
in
a lot
Texas,
of money.
Or does he just come down there a lot?
What's that?
Does Scott have a residence in Texas, or is, because I know obviously he's Canadian, but he just flies down there all the time?
Yeah, he's all over the place. Yeah. So, but it was cool seeing Scott, and he sent me a message, and I forwarded it to Dennis. You know, he was like, "Man, I had like 500 short conversations that day. Sorry, we didn't get to talk as much." You know, it is the nature of the program, and I said, "For sure." You know, I felt bad for Dennis. I think we both envisioned, you know, unicorns and fairy tales, and we're just going to hang out with Dale Dye for 8 hours and have them all to ourselves, right? Like that ain't happening. But
yeah, but as
one of the other highlights,
as an organizer, as you've organized enough of these events to know the insanity and the logistics that go along with it. And so, I mean, you're not completely surprised by it at all.
No, just, not at all. And it turned out well, because the unsubscribe thing happened, and that was a lot of fun. So, but another highlight, and I want to hand over to the mic to Dennis now for a little bit, but, you know, I spent 5 years working at that museum, countless hours. Now, of course, I wasn't always up at the main gallery. You know, my headquarters was the battlefield 2 blocks away, but still spent a lot of time in that museum and different things. And I probably walked by the Memorial Courtyard, I don't know how many times, and Don, I know you were in the courtyard before. You just plaques upon plaques upon plaques, and all the rock walls that separate the courtyard and the Japanese garden. And then when you walk to the Bush Gallery, there's plaques everywhere. There's memorial bricks everywhere. But to be with Dennis, for him to walk us directly to the memorial plaque for his grandfather's LCI gunboat, LCI 449, it gave me chills, man, because it was like, it gave meaning to something that was meaningless to me, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but it was just, you walk past all this stuff all the time, and then all of a sudden, there's one that's now like a beacon that I know this story. And the plaque, it's a beautiful plaque, and all the names of the crew are on there, and if they were wounded in action or killed in action, so I'm seeing all of these names. Like, I know what happened to that guy. I know this. I know how he died. It was so cool. And if I'd have just seen it by myself, I'd have taken a picture and sent it to Dennis. But to have Dennis walk me to it, you know, Dennis was then the tour guide. And I was just like, wow, I didn't even know this plaque was here. I walked past it 100,000 times. So that was, aside from the people that we met and the things we got to do, man, that was a highlight for me for sure that day, to see LCI 449's plaque.
Was that your first time seeing that plaque, Dennis, or have you been to the museum a few times?
No, I've got a lot of time at that museum. Got my start there years ago, back in 04, 05, when Admiral Grosjean was running it. And then he handed it off to General Hagee. But I raised the money for that plaque. and got it when I used it to contact all the families from the 449 when I was doing the book. Got with all them. We all pooled our money together. I think the plaque cost $2,500. And it's 20 by 20. I designed it, put all the names. I wanted to make sure that all the names were on there, even the observers, the UDT observer, the Marine Corps UDT observer. And then what happened to them, like if they're wounded or killed or Bronze Star, Silver Star, Rufus Herring got the Medal of Honor. And then a picture of the ship, picture of Rufus Herring. Then I was able to, you know, tell Jeff about the setting, that there was a giant tent there that day, and there was over 100 people, and they had come from all over the country. And Lawrence Bozarth's mom was there. She is a Gold Star mom. He died at Iwo Jima on the 449. His mom was there, and his siblings, and the executive officer or the engineering officer from the 474 gunboat beside my grandpa's that sunk, that he was there. The 471 gunnery officer on the bow gun deck, he was there. And I got to talk to him about all these different people that he'd heard about, and tell him about all the news crews that were there that day. It was a cold February day. It was 2005. It was, you know, to the day, you know, it was the day of there at Iwo Jima. And it was pretty awesome to be able to walk Jeff up there. And then behind us, there's a plaque for Raphael Johnson over on the wall, too. And it's something else that Jeff had passed by many times as well. And, you know, Raphael Johnson has his own little personal plaque. He's the only African-American sailor on the gunboat. And we were able to, I got with the crew and the families, and they all raised the money again. And the Johnson family got a hold of them. We got his brother and some grandsons, and they all came, and we had a dedication ceremony. So yeah, that was pretty special.
We're going to have Christoph on again next month, because he's been sending me the inside baseball photos, and you guys weren't here for that episode. I did one-on-one because he's over in Belgium, and with the time restrictions, we did like on an afternoon on a Saturday, but he raised the funds to help design, along with a team, two different monuments, one in Belgium and then a plaque in Germany honoring a B-17 crew that was shot down. And he was telling me about, imagine that, Germany's not super big on, you know, remembering these sort of things. And so the kind of loopholes and red tape involved in getting a plaque mounted in Germany is completely different. But I want to try to have you on, because obviously Jeff too, but the reason I want to have you on is, as I told Christoph, living historians, and me and Jeff have said this, and Henry has said it when we've been on the podcast, living historians say we do this because we're trying to preserve history. Well, you and Christoph actually are preserving history. You're one of the few people who actually take the history and go through the process of getting plaques made and raising the money and finding a designer. And, you know, like if Jeff and I said, you know, let's get a plaque for this person, I'm sure we would get it done. But, you know, because you've done it, the amount of work. I mean, I wouldn't even know what, do I go to a baseball trophy guy? I mean, I wouldn't even know where to begin to look for a quality monument creator, or, you know, a plaque's one thing, but in the case of Christoph, he had 2 6-foot statues made of 2 B-17 airmen who you had to find an artist to get that. So the amount of effort, and I want to commend you for, you know, you and the people involved in getting those plaques made for your grandfather's gunship, you know, that is, it's one thing to say, hey, I'm a living historian, I want to preserve history, and then to do what you did. I mean, my hats, I would literally take my hat off for you, but my headset's on. That's just, I'm proud of you. I mean, I know it was a long time ago, but to hear that, it's, I don't know, to me, it's just mind blowing the amount of effort, time, and dedication it puts forth to getting a plaque, a monument, anything that's going to be a permanent structure, and, you know, created like that. And it's one thing to have it put, you know, put on a private property or museum, but like in Christoph's case, getting this passed and cleared and put in on a piece of city property is even harder, especially in, you know, formerly your enemy's territory, which is now modern day Germany. But yeah, I would love to have you on when he comes back on, try to make the times in work, because I think you guys could really communicate the effort and energy of what it takes to get that done, because that's tremendous.
It's neat to know that there's people just like you that have the same passion and the same drive and the same dedication to, and to feel the weight of responsibility that's self-imposed from people you never met and you most of the time you never knew, but you feel that weight of responsibility and it moves you to do so many things and to put up with so much while others are having fun or going to the movies. You're putting in time on the computer and you're researching and you're contacting people and you're putting pennies away and you're traveling and interviewing, and it's neat to know that there's people like the gentleman you're talking about over there in Europe that, you know, did the same exact thing. I'd love to meet him. Another one that I would really like to meet would be Adam Makos, because we, around the same time, we're both crisscrossing the country together, on our way to interview people, and probably passed each other on separate highways many times on different excursions to go interview. I was thinking of the other day when I was talking to Dale Dye, and I was standing there and I was looking at everybody, and I my mind wandered, and I was thinking about my trip that I, one of the trips I took, and sitting in a farmhouse in Shelbina, Missouri, and the farmer, Ken Huff, his floor was being ripped up and his wife was there. She had an apron on, a really pretty blue dress with white flowers on it. And we sat in this kitchen around this giant hole with men down in the hole and hammers and nails and banging. And his wife brought little discs of ice cream over to us with cherries on top. And it was, I'm getting goosebumps even thinking about it. Like, how lucky could I get to have that experience to sit with the bosun's mate, first class, Kenneth Huff from LCIG 473 at Iwo Jima, Bronze Star recipient. And here I am for Valor. Here I am sitting in his farmhouse in Shelbina, Missouri, and his wife is dishing out ice cream in these really cute little ceramic bowls for us. And you just pinch yourself, you know?
Well, hopefully we can make that happen without a Makos. I talked to him like 2 weeks ago. He's out of town. He actually lives here where I live now, and he's supposed to be sending an autographed book when he gets back in town for us to give away on Patreon. And he said he's going to come on to promote his project once it's at promotion stage. So we will have him on the show in the near future, so you'll have the opportunity to talk to him and check that out.
One of my favorite was I was in Cairo, Illinois, where General Grant had his headquarters during the Civil War when he was in the Western campaign, and he was trying to get back to Mississippi for the Union. And, you know, I'm in Cairo and I was there to try and find Clarence Kepner, who was the cook on the ship and had both legs amputated at Iwo Jima. And I was there just on a whim. I was driving and I was like, well, I'm just going to stop and just see if I can. And I pull in, go to the library. It's closed. I had done some research. And so I found this address for a Kepner, went there, knocked on the door. Nobody answered, left a message into the door, you know, Dennis Blocker, please give me a call. But I had to go. I had to leave. I had to go to keep on pushing to Belleville, Illinois for an interview I had to do that night in my hotel room in Belleville with a crew member from the USS Terror, minesweeper, who went aboard the 449 and helped clean up all the body parts and whatnot. So I'm bummed. I was hoping I could find a Kepner. I'm pulling out of Cairo. And as I'm pulling out, I look over to the right and I see the volunteer fire station, and there's a bunch of old guys there, and they're kind of standing in a little huddle and they're talking and laughing. And a little voice was like, turn around. So I turn around, I park, I walked up. Fellas, my name's Dennis from San Antonio, Texas, trying to find a guy that was with my grandpa at Iwo Jima. His name was Clarence Kepner. One of the guys goes, that's my uncle.
Wow.
And from there, he put me in touch with Clarence's daughters. He had moved to California, and they in turn sent me photographs and letters from the war that he had sent, and memoir that he wrote. So it's just amazing. Those kind of stories are just, I would love to have a conversation with Adam about where we could just commiserate about those little cool little coincidences that happen along the way. You know, it's just pretty cool.
Yeah, when he was on, he was explaining how him and his brother kind of got started in all this. And they were kind of, back in the day, making little historical pamphlets and brochures that they'd give out at air shows and World War II events. That's like, it reminds me a lot of in the 90s in Columbus, we had at Dodge Skate Park, the guy who ran Dodge Skate Park, who the park was actually co-designed by Tony Hawk's father, guy named Donnie ran a place, and he had a little black and white magazine he put out called Smelly Curb Zine. He like literally made it in his apartment, went down to Kinko's back when Kinko's was a thing, and printed up little black and white, you know, it was just basically computer paper stapled together, and he had little articles and all that. And so when Adam was talking about how they got started, in my mind I'm visualizing those old 1990s, you know, 80s, 90s underground little black and white magazines that people used to put out. And
that's such good stuff.
That was the way it was before the internet blew up.
Kinko saved me so many times when I was on the road because families would just hand me a stack of photographs.
Oh, I
can, you know, imagine. And then I could take them to Kinko's and just make them into photographs myself. And, you know, Xerox, I put so much time in Kinko's across the country. Oh. Yeah, that place saved me so many times.
Now, were you making hard copies or was this at the time where you could go have them digitized?
Yeah, I was making hard copies. And I would also like make color Xerox copies, but I always try to make actual photographs on their photo machines as well. Yeah, that way I could have the better quality. You know, of course, as the tech advanced, I mean, now you can just have your phone and you just got these great PDF scanners and whatnot. You can do it all on your phone now. But
you can go on Amazon and they have 35 millimeter negative USB adapters where you can they're like photo scanners, like your print scanner, but you just slide your 35 millimeter negative in there and launch the app and take screenshots, and it'll flip it over, you know, it'll turn it into a digital photo. You can actually
do that for the negatives.
Yeah, it's one of my old clients had one because he had all these. Not only did he have negatives, he actually had the old school slides, and he was digitizing like his, you know, he was 72, so he had all these slides from the 50s and 60s from when he was growing up. And so he every year he was digitizing negatives and slides, and it's just a little black box hooks up with the USB. It's a little light in there, and you can literally slide the negatives in there, 35 millimeter one at a time, where I think you can even do a contact paper too.
Oh, like, man, I need to get one of those because I've got a lot of negatives.
Yeah, we can track that down.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But yeah, I'm glad you guys had a look at that beautiful coffee mug. That's a beaut. That's a beautiful coffee mug. I got to try one of the new ones out. Speaking of coffee
mug. Oh, you know what? It was nice to see Liberty Phillips, too. Liberty was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was nice. I didn't know she was going to be there. I hadn't seen her in a long time. And she was like, Dennis? And she's like, last time I saw you, you had a giant beard.
Going incognito.
I was like, yeah, that's me.
If you guys want to get yourself one of these sweet-ass coffee mugs that Jeff and I have, or a t-shirt like I have, or Jeff has, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the merch link. Get yourself a nice hat, kind of like the one I have. I know Jeff just ordered him a hat or two. Get yourself a shirt and all that good stuff. It goes a long way to promote what we do here. And while you're there, if you haven't done so yet, click on the Patreon link, sign up and subscribe. It's $1 a month. It goes a long way to support what we also do here as well. And like I said, we're working on some giveaways. I know we're going to have an autographed Adam Makis book. I know Jeff had to work in the background. He's working on a possible giveaway. So we're going to keep those going. We are working on adding more video exclusive content to Patreon. Just be patient with us because, as I was saying before we went into the show, it takes a long time to update these videos with some quality audio. And I'm actually working on one now, which will be up here soon. It's the first appearance of Henry Sledge when he was on the show showing us his dad's gun and the K-bar and all the stories behind that and much, much more. So please head over to our website and do that. And we haven't heard from you guys in a while. Email us. It's part of partly our problem. We don't mention enough. Email us at mailcall@WTSPWorldWar2.com. Questions, comments, suggestions. And as we said in the past, if you think there's a topic you want to hear us talk about, or maybe you have, you know, a topic that's your strong point whenever you do living history presentations and you want to come on the show and help educate our audience, please reach out to us. mailcall@WTSPWorldWar2.com. You know, we are a community here, and, you know, it's a wide, vast topic that not everybody can know everything about every little thing. We all have our strong points, and there's only three of us here. And so you want to add to our strong points, please reach out to us and do that. We haven't done this.
Hey, Don, can I give a shout out?
Absolutely not. No, go
ahead. I want to just say thank you to the – I know there's been a couple subscribers that have reached out, private messaged me about ordering some of the books that I've written. And I just wanted to let folks know I really appreciate their patience. I hadn't been able to send anything out because my dad went into cardiac arrest after his surgery the other day. And we thought we were going to lose him. They got him back. Awesome. And he's been on the road recovery. So I've been spending a lot of nights in the hospitals. He's now walking. Of course, he's talking. He's got a sense of humor and he's making great strides. But there was a lot of, in the hospital. And so books didn't get sent. But haven't forgot. It's going to happen. I appreciate everybody's patience with that. It's been pretty rough. A lot of nights in the hospital, no showers for days, and just touch and go, trying to encourage dad. He's used to being an alpha and being on top, and a dog trainer, Afghanistan, Iraq, retired policeman, Air Force cop, very active even now. And for him to get hit with that unexpectedly from negligence, and he has had some down days, and thankfully I've been there to say, hey, you have a right to be bummed out, but we can't afford that for too long because you've got to get busy and you've got stuff to do and you've got books to write and you've got dogs needing to be trained and you've got all these thousands of people all across the world sending messages from England, Australia, Belgium, Germany, Canada, all over the place, sending messages to dad. We're praying for you. Keep after it. You need to get done because we need these books. So anyway, that's kind of an update on my dad, but I appreciate everybody's prayers.
Yeah, I was very excited to see your post talking about how he's on the mends. And if you guys missed the episode 2 weeks ago, it was just Dennis and I. We did a deep dive on Dennis's book, Clear, and his background. And one of the things that I noticed during the interview is the amount of passion and the hold that those memories in that book still has on Dennis. You can hear it in his voice when he talks about it. And so if you want to get that book, please head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Look for that episode. There's links on where you can purchase it on Amazon. And as Dennis has said on that episode as well, reach out to us, whether it's through Dennis's social media, which you can get linked on our website, or to mail call at WTSPWorldWar2.com. Dennis will happily send you his Venmo account for a small fee. You can just buy the book directly off of him, and he will autograph it and personalize it to you and send it to you, opposed to just getting, one from Amazon. It's just blanking off the shelf. He will happily autograph one and personalize it for you or a family member if you want to do it as a gift.
Yep.
So mail call at WTSP World War II. Just put clear in the subject line and we'll pass it on to Dennis. And you guys get a copy of his book. Speaking of books, hey, Jeff, what you reading?
Jeez. Well, I came prepared because I'm reading a lot right now because I have to because I'm studying World War I. So I've got a couple of them here with me that I would highly recommend. And we talk about this a lot. I know this is a World War II podcast, but you can't get World War II unless you get World War I. Mm-hmm. So if you read one book about World War I, it's gotta be The American Heritage: History of World War I by Brigadier General S.L.A. Marshall. This is about as scaled down a version as you're going to get. This is World War I start to finish. This has been a really, really entertaining read. And honestly, if you've ever read anything from S.L.A. Marshall, this is a good read. I mean, it's an easy read as well.
What's the copyright date on some that of these, guy?
What's that?
It looks like a relatively modern cover. What's the copyright date on that? Like late 80s or early 90s?
Come on, you know me better than that. 66.
Well, I saw the cover and it kind of has that. It has the stylization of that photo, at least over the Zoom. It kind of looks like a more modern cover. So,
oh yeah, no, not at all. I'm still working on, because this is part of my thesis. So I'm reading Billy Mitchell's Memoirs of World War One. This is a first edition printing as well. This book that I have. Man, if the military would have listened to Billy Mitchell in 1917, holy smokes. I can't wait to write about this, because so many things could have been different going into the Second World War from an aviation perspective.
It would have been that much more advanced, you're saying? We would have been ahead of the game?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know necessarily ahead of the game, but I think just more from a strategic standpoint, how we utilize air, because the French.
Well, and didn't he predict Pearl Harbor, Jeff?
I think a lot of guys from the First World War predicted Pearl Harbor. Yeah. But Billy Mitchell's definitely one that, he saw the handwriting on the wall. But it was the French that first understood that you need to use airplanes on the offensive, not on the defensive. And you have to put a whole bunch of them together and fly in formations and attack. You know, before it was just from, honestly, it was just from an observation perspective, right? They were just sent up to spot for the artillery, because World War One was going to be, fought and won on artillery. Mm-hmm. In 1916, it was attrition. Let's just make a rain of fire and artillery shells. So aviation was just a way to get above the battlefield and spot. And you kind of stayed in your side and they stayed over there, and that was it. And the reason that, so many of the German pilots survived being shot down so many times is because it was the British and the French that finally, and late, later on the American pilots, going over the lines, going beyond no man's land, going beyond the German trenches and attacking targets, attacking the German aviation. So as they're getting shot down, behind their own lines, whereas the Entente and the Allied powers are getting shot down behind enemy lines. So, but starting as early as May of 1917, a month after U.S. enters the war, Billy Mitchell was already there, touring British, French, and Canadian forces on the front lines. He was shelled several times. He understood from the French, aviation perspective that airplanes need to be offensive. They need to work in formations. You need to have pursuit planes that are specifically designed for pursuit, and you need to have bombers that are specifically designed for bombing. And this is in 1917.
Were they all still primarily canvas made at that point?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. This is long before the aluminum monoplanes and things like that.
Yeah. Gone to wood yet.
Yeah. So that's been a really interesting read from Billy Mitchell. And then, of course, the First World War, the War to End All Wars. I'm reading a lot of books, guys, on World War One right now. I'm reading about five, including the memoirs. I mean, it doesn't get any more boring and dry than this, but the memories, letters, and documents of Moltke the Younger, Helmuth von Moltke, who was the first general chief of staff for the Germans. He lasted about 3 months into the war and was sacked in October of 1914. But a lot of relevant stuff even here, even in a German general in 1914, it's relevant to what our boys were going through not 30 years later.
How's the comprehension on the translation of that? And reason I ask that, we've talked about jokingly, like if you just go read a Life magazine from 1943, just the basic changes in grammar and some of the vernacular they use in that 80 years takes a little comprehension. And, case of me, you might have to read it once or twice, but you're going back to reading text that's translated from German to English and it's from 1918. How's the reading of that book, like just the terminology they use or the vernacular of the day once it's been translated?
I haven't come across a word I don't recognize. Well, honestly,
I guess not maybe a word you don't recognize, but maybe the structure, how they spoke back then, I guess, is what more I'm leaning towards.
Yeah. Is it an easy read or a hard read?
All of these have been, like I said, they've been really easy reading. Billy Mitchell, there was a couple, I guess, slang type terms. you know, just military slang that you know what he's talking about. Maybe it's not a familiar term today, but I mean, the one that was translated from German, you know, Moltke's basically Moltke's memoirs. I mean, if it gives you any idea, I can read a few things here. And this is from the Kaiser after Moltke passed away in 1916. So this is from Kaiser Wilhelm II to Mrs. von Moltke. He says, "I have just received the shocking news of the sudden death of your husband. I'm at a loss for words to give full expression to my feelings on this occasion. Deeply moved, I remember his illness at the beginning of this war, the brilliant preparation of which was the content of his restless activity as chief of the general staff of the army. The fatherland will not forget his high merits, and I will keep him in grateful memory as long as I live. What this upright, clever man with the golden character and the warm, loyal heart was for me and the army. In sincere sorrow, I express my heartfelt sympathy to you and your children. I know that I have lost a true friend in him." Kaiser Wilhelm II. So,
pretty good.
That's 100 and however many years old and translated from German to English. It's an easy read.
Yeah, it's nice.
But good question.
Well, the reason I ask is because I've been super wicked busy around here. I'm just now getting on the back end of my Marauders book, believe it or not. I just finally sat down to read again. But there's some sentences in there, or even some word placement. I'm like, was this a typo? Were they meant to use a different word here that would read easier? But it was just the way the author, you know, structured his language then. It's just like there's a couple times like that word just doesn't make sense there. It seems like there should be a different word, but I can't imagine, yeah. You know, the editor missed it. I mean, it's just the way he wrote, I guess. Hey, Dennis, what you reading, fella?
I'm reading a book called Scars and Stripes by Lieutenant Commander Eugene B. Red McDaniels. He was shot down over Vietnam and spent 7 years in a POW camp, Hanoi Hilton. Talks about his being tortured and talks about them developing the code. First-hand account, I got to actually see him when I was in college. He spoke at our college to the student body. Tremendous book, easy read, but difficult subject matter. And just to, you know, those guys, it's just, you know, they're holding out information that, is it like really, like it's not really going to affect the war, but they just have this thing where they're not going to tell them, you know, and they're just being tortured. And
really obviously something. None of us have been in that position, but we've read books where people were in similar situations like that. Sometimes it seems like when you're in that situation, you're holding on to a piece of information, like you said, maybe not that detrimental to the outcome of the war, but it's almost like they're holding on to it as if to say F you, you're not going to break
yeah
me.
For sure, that's exactly, you what know, he said. Actually, Don,
you can torture
said
me as much
was
you want.
A,
I'm not
every
gonna
day
tell
was
you.
A small victory.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you what size shoe I wear, you know, just something, just yeah, you can take a lot of things from me, but you're not taking that.
Yep, for sure. With every day was a small little victory being able to do those things. Yeah, pretty cool.
Just goes
to what are you reading? Marauder's book?
Yeah, I'm finally on the back end of that, getting that one caught up. And then I'm looking at my my physical books here in my bookshelf. That I'm trying to figure out what I want to jump onto next. If I want to stay in the Pacific, or if I want to go back over to European theater, or
Salman King, maybe 50 Shades of Grey, something like that.
50 Shades More.
What's that one, Jeff?
Just World War One.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I do have an update. You mentioned earlier on the giveaway. I do have an update. So if you don't already follow, let me make sure I get this correct here. It's Military Aerospace Art. If you don't follow Military Aerospace Art and you appreciate aviation art, you're going to want to follow them. So they're the ones that reached out to me about a print about a P-51 who shot down a P-51 pilot who shot down an Arado 234 German jet on the 19th of March 1945. So the deal was that I'm going to get one for me, and we're going to get one to give away for What's the Scuttlebutt listeners, and they will be signed by the pilot, Huey Lamb Jr. He was a first lieutenant at the time, flying his P-51 Mustang, the Etta Jean II. He intercepted and destroyed a low-flying Arado 234 jet, and he's also credited with shooting down an ME-262 on a different mission, flying a P-47. So they sent me pictures of Lieutenant Lamb signing the print. They're, let me look at the dimensions here. I want to say, 20 by 16, so it's not like it's a huge poster. That's a nice, decent-sized print. Yeah. It's a beautiful picture of this checkered, black and white checkered cowling, you know, P-51 down in this German jet. I'm really excited. I'm hoping this thing, they said they could send it as quick as tomorrow.
Wow.
I don't know where they come from. I think it's UK based. So we'll have to see, but I will let you know as soon as I get it. And then I'm excited about that giveaway because that's a hot item for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, for sure. That's
absolutely.
Awesome. Signed by a World War II vet.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II paced podcast. We want to thank each and every one of you for your continued support, and for myself, Jeff Copsetta, Mr. Dennis Big Chin Blocker. Thank you guys so much, and we'll talk to you all next week.
I'll take care.
This has been a Digital 410 production.